The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for July the 21st. I'm Alok Cha. Coming up on this week's show, how much can you tell from looking at a skeleton? We'll discuss how the study of ancient bones can tell the story of an entire city. Also in the podcast,
from a physical taxing standpoint, you know, it's just a reasonably healthy individual can do this. There's no special requirements other than reasonable health that are required to pull it off. An adventurous spirit is the number one thing.
Video game designer Richard Garriott gets to follow in his father's footsteps and boldly go where few men have gone before. Plus, the 30th anniversary of the world's first test tube baby, the kidney stone belt in the US, and NASA want your urine. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. With me today is Guardian Science correspondent James Randerson. Hello, James.
Oh, they always thought NASA were taking the piss.
Yeah, we'll come to that many times later. In case you're missing him, Science Daddy Ian Sample will be in the pod a bit later to take us through some of this week's news stories. But this week we've got not one, but two special guests. Jelena Bekvalets from the Museum of London and Emily Sargent, curator from the Wellcome Collection. They're here to talk about Skeletons, London's Buried Bones, an exhibition featuring a range of samples from a collection of 17,000 skeletons. These bones uncover 2,000 years of history and give us an insight into the health, diet, diseases, and lifestyle of the deceased. Let's start with you, Jelena. Tell us where the bones have come from. You've got this many thousand skeletons. Where are they all from?
They've all come from the development of London. So as all the different buildings have been built over the many years, they've actually come from excavations when they've started to build new buildings. And so then that's revealed old burial grounds, church cemeteries, and areas that we probably didn't know people had been buried before. So really it's just from the growth and development of London over the last 2,000 years.
And I alluded to this in the introduction, but you can tell a lot from even badly decayed bones and things. I mean, you've actually brought some in with you. And a fascinating array of sort of jaws and bits of spine and all sorts of things. It's a bit disturbing, actually. tell us what information you can glean about, you know, what people were eating or how people died and that kind of thing.
Well, cause of death is something that we have real problems with. I mean, what we see are diseases that people have suffered from a long time. So we need something to be chronic. Something that's fast acting won't change the integrity of the bone. So I need someone to have had something for quite a long time for it to change the nature of the bone or to have some sort of traumatic incident. You can tell a lot just from single elements, which we have here, but we also do the research analysis on more complete skeletons. You don't always get complete skeletons because obviously the nature of building, you've got truncation, and so you don't always get a whole skeleton to analyse. From that, though, we'll look at certain areas. So we'll look at the skull and the pelvis if we're trying to sex the individual. So we're trying to say if it's male or female in an adult. And we'll also look at those areas for ageing. Ageing, unfortunately, when we're adults, is really all about degeneration. So it's wear and tear. And when you're a sub-adult, so when you're a child, it's much easier because you've got the growth and development of the bones that we can measure and also the development of the teeth so they can be more tightly aged.
Well, let's go through some of the examples you've got in front of us here. Can you describe to us, for example, if you take you've got two jaws there, and one of them has a perfect set of teeth, which I'm sure it's better than
Hollywood leading.
It does.
I don't believe that they're ancient teeth at all. And then next to them, you've got quite manky ones.
Hideous wear, yes.
So tell us what's the difference.
Yes. Well, the first one does look a bit like, you know, sort of Tom Cruise American Idol teeth, really, doesn't it? This one really is just to sort of show you a fantastic example of a male jaw, because that's one area that we'll look at for sexing. So you've got really lovely flared parts.
So what you've got there is just a lower jaw, and it's sort of, obviously the colour is sort of a nice brown. It's been in the earth for a while.
Good dentist. Yeah, pretty, quite a young individual. I mean, if we use this for ageing, there's not a lot of the wear pattern that we look for on all of the molars, which are your back teeth. There is a bit of calculus, which is the tartar. So if you don't clean your teeth, then this starts to build up. And so this was just to bring in to show you what a lovely set of teeth can look like.
So people did have amazingly good oral hygiene back then?
Well, not really, no. I mean, what it is, what we tend to see is in the medieval period, you tend to have a much coarser, grittier diet, so you tend to get more wear. Then as you go into the post-medieval period and the introduction of sugar, then unfortunately that's when you start to get nasty carious lesions and you get tooth rot.
And holes and all that sort of stuff. Which is Ablig's demonstrated by the next example.
No, please do, yes. That one's a lovely example.
James, tell us about these two.
Disgusting. Well, this is a...
well, it's just slightly different.
Certainly not a Hollywood leading man anyway. This again is a lower jaw and quite a few teeth missing that presumably fell out after death. But there are some here which... look very worn and sort of brownish and nasty.
The enamel's completely worn away on the front part, where you, both your jaws meet. On this one, it doesn't look as though they're meeting nicely right on the midline. It actually looks as though it's coming over the top. So they're wearing from the upper to the lower.
Is
completely worn. Surface.
And you say you can tell what kind of food people were eating. So what are the coarser kind of things people might have been eating before sugar came along?
Well, usually something, if they had the flour, if they were making the bread, then sometimes from the quern stones or the actual process, you'll still have bits of stone and grit, and that's then going to be in what you're eating, and that's then going to be wearing down your teeth. Or you might be doing something, so you might be using your teeth as a tool, and then that will create a different wear pattern as well. So sometimes if you were softening leather or holding twine, that might wear the teeth as well.
So those are the jaws. You've got other things here. There's a bit of back here, backbone.
Ah, yes.
And what can that tell us?
Well, this is your fifth lumbar vertebrae, so the vertebrae in the lower part of your back. And this is to show you that this really should be one whole part, but I've got two parts. And this is a lovely thing called spondylolisthesis. And they're not sure whether it's something you might be born with, so it might be congenital, or it could be that you've got some sort of microtrauma. So if you're doing a lot of bending or lifting, there might be a fine fracture line there, and then it just never has a chance to unite to make one part.
Presumably not so lovely for the person who had spondylolisthesis.
No. It'd probably be rather painful and uncomfortable, yes. And I hurt my back last week, so I can completely understand what felt like.
There's a really interesting one here, which is, I think, an arm bone. And there's what looks like a kind of huge growth about one-fifth of the way down from the end. And it almost looks like it's been broken and then sort of badly glued back together. What's happening there?
Yes, well, it has been broken, but, I mean, the person actually did break it as opposed to it being broken afterwards. And so it's healed back, but it just hasn't lined up as it should do. And so that lovely lump you're describing is the callus, so the healing process. And it's your radius, one of the bones in your lower arm. And, yes, it's malaligned, but it hasn't got an infection. So the person was rather lucky, so that would indicate it was a closed fracture, because infection would be the thing that could be very dangerous and potentially kill you.
And at what point did people start sort of setting fractures? And, you know, presumably that didn't happen in that case.
No, that one wasn't reduced. No, well, probably very early on. I mean, I think they've got examples from, you know, the Egyptians and Greeks and Romans, Chinese. So they were aware of the body, but no, this one unfortunately hasn't been.
Case.
So it's gone back in. Yes, it's healed, but just not in the right alignment.
Emily, let's bring you in now. So the Wellcome Collection is taking a whole bunch of these bones and displaying them. Tell us why you were interested in doing that in the first place. What was it? Was it part of a bigger exhibition, or is it just quite macabre bones? You quite like the idea of displaying dead things.
Well, we were invited to the Museum of London one day to see their collection of 17,000 of skeletons that have been uncovered during London's evolution as a city, which was an opportunity that was just too fascinating for us to resist, really. And the idea of an exhibition which was essentially a room full of skeletons just seemed like a really great opportunity to not only examine what the bones can tell us about the health and well-being of London's previous residents, but also to kind of connect ourselves with our own skeletons, our own makeup, and through that, with the past residents of London too. So we're trying to kind of unite these kind of three topics, both the medical aspect of it at the individual level, and then the kind of greater sense of London's history and geography.
Well, that medical aspect's quite interesting. As we discussed, you can tell all sorts about people's pathology from old bones. And I mean, does anyone study bones in a sort of medical context, archaeologically? I mean, to work out what kinds of diseases people died from and kind of how people are living now compared to many, many hundreds of years ago?
Yes, well, that's probably what really we do. I mean, we're osteologists, osteoarchaeologists, because we work with the bones from people who've been long dead. So we're looking to see what things have been affected and what types of diseases they've had. But we also need the archaeology history then to put that into context so that then that reflects into what sort of environment they might have lived in, the diet they might have had, the sort of infectious diseases they might have come into contact. So we're trying to build a picture of them as an individual and then also on a population level and then, you know, the society that they lived in.
Just before we wind up this little bit, we were talking earlier and you both mentioned that actually when it comes down to human remains, no one can own these things. What's the story behind that? Oh, I didn't know that. So no one actually owns these bones sitting here on the table.
No, no. We actually curate and care for them, yes, but they cannot be owned by anybody. There's, I don't know all of the details, but there's a great debate at the moment in the Ministry of Justice about the burial law and the burial licences. It's all being reinterpreted, but it's a very complex area. But, yes, nobody can actually own the...
So if James walks off with one, which he's want to do...
No, I'm sorry, James, you can't...
One or two of those little thigh bones that are sitting here to sort of show to people.
I was just thinking there's more life in this pod than we've had for a few weeks.
They are fantastic.
That's an unfortunate statement, James. Look, we're going to have more from Yelena and Emily a bit later on, but you can get all the info you need about the Wellcome Collections exhibition at wellcomecollection.org.uk. I'm Alok Jha, you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, we'll hear from space tourist Richard Garriott. First, though, here are some of the other stories making science headlines in the past 7 days. Here's Ian, briefly, and James with your news jam.
News jam.
Fertility scientists this week will celebrate the 30th anniversary of the birth of Louise Brown, the world's first test tube baby. To mark the anniversary, the journal Nature asked experts to predict what fertility medicine will come up with in the next 30 years. Amongst other things, they predicted that fertility doctors of 2038 will be making artificial sperm, nurturing embryos in artificial wombs, and helping parents choose their perfect child.
Global warming will put 2.25 million more Americans at risk of kidney stones by 2050, according to researchers who investigated the effect of climate change on the condition. Kidney stones are much more common in the hotter southern states, and the researchers predict this kidney stone belt will expand.
UK regulations controlling the use of human tissue by scientists are stifling research, according to an investigation by the think tank Newton's Apple. The report describes the costs of the regulations as substantial and calls for a review of legislation governing the use of human tissue.
And finally, NASA is seeking volunteers to boldly go. The high-tech gurus at America's space agency need a supply of urine samples to test out their latest designs for space toilets. Urine poses a unique problem for space travellers because it contains solids that can clog the plumbing of even the most sophisticated spacecraft. The agency needs 30 litres a day, although there's a personal limit of 350 millilitres.
James and Ian, thanks very much. We'll get on to the piss story in a moment. Ian, the future of IVF. You were at the ESHRAE conference recently, which I'm sure gave you a glimpse into this future, but the guys in Nature were looking even further forward. Tell us a few of the highlights.
Yeah, so one thing that came up that was quite common, and, you know, these are credible people, so bear with us, was the use of IPS, which is induced pluripotency cells. So this is the idea of taking, say, a skin cell, reprogramming it back to the, like, an embryonic state, and then differentiating it onwards to make it become a sperm cell or an egg cell. And these guys are saying, look, in the next 30 years, we might have nailed down that technology so you can make sperm and eggs. And in that case, one of the people in here is saying, essentially, you could have a child from anyone from a baby to 100 years old.
And my question is, would you want a child from a baby?
personally,
of course,
no.
You wouldn't. No.
Personally,
stupid question. What else is there in that list?
There's the usual stuff about artificial uteruses, artificial wombs, mechanical wombs, whatever you want to call them. And this is basically looking at if you look at how sort of this kind of medicine is going, you can keep babies alive sort of for longer and longer, kind of. There's an idea that there are people working on the idea of just being able to take a fetus through to its sort of whole gestational period outside the body. And but it raises, even if it's possible, it raises some sort of pretty interesting ethical issues. And one of the guys in here is talking about, if it ever became a reality, would there be pressure on governments to use them to sort of save aborted fetuses, which would give you something like a million extra births in the US each year? Would some people be forced to have their fetus grown in an artificial womb because they're on crack or something and they're not going to be a responsible mother? So it brings in these sort of like, perhaps outlandish at the moment, ethical issues.
I don't reckon you have to be on crack to be a bad mum. But James, he points out something quite interesting there, which is that there are tons of ethical things that are going to guide where all of this goes, because technically it seems that nearly everything's going to be possible.
Well, yes, given enough time, I suppose so. I mean, one thing about the artificial wombs, I mean, you always hear those stories about, you know, the end of men, we won't need men anymore because, you know, we can make sperm out of other cells or whatever. But the nice thing about this is you won't need women. So it's the end of women story. Well, I'm not sure that's the nice thing, but it's...
Why is that? Well, how could that ever be a nice thing?
Nice is the wrong word. It's kind of nice to, you know, be able to turn things around.
I love you.
Can we clip that bit out and play it on a regular basis? Ian, save us from this madman who wants to get rid of women.
I just want to mention one more thing that the fertility doctors raised in this piece, which I think is actually pretty genuinely interesting, was obviously there's a lot of fuss talked about the possibility of designer babies and what we'll be able to do with genetics in the future. There's one of the people writing in this piece is talking about how maybe in 30 years in IVF clinics, women will have, or couples will have, their embryos produced, and say this will be about 8 embryos, is pretty sort of standard number. You could then know the entire genome of each of those embryos. And although you won't be able to say before going into clinic, I want a tall, blonde, blue-eyed, intelligent child, you'll be able to look at those embryos and see, you know, she was saying, so one embryo may have 3 genes for height, you know, 2 genes for, not intelligence, but sort of, I don't know, some sort of physiological aspect, and a few other genes for disease. And so you might be able to choose between the embryos according to, you know, your preferred baby. So it's getting towards designery.
But then would you have to have all of the other ones grown in artificial wombs somewhere? anyone predicting the future in technology of any sort is woefully wrong, usually. In the 50s, they were talking about flying cars and all sorts of spacesuits and sugar pills and protein pills and things. I mean, obviously now with the stuff that's in nature that we were talking about just now, all of this stuff is almost here anyway. You can kind of see it happening, the artificial wombs and the sort of designer babies and things. But how much of this do you think is a bit of willful speculation, and how much of it is just, look, it's going to happen whether we like it or not, and therefore we might as well get ready with the ethics?
I think the most interesting one of these is the idea that you may know the genome of embryos, but if you go through an IVF clinic. But because that seems really plausible at the moment. You know, we do this thing called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where you're plucking off one cell really early on and you're checking it. You're already doing a lot of genetic testing on it. You know, it's not implausible that in 30 years, not at all implausible that in 30 years you'd be able to give that whole genetic rundown. But, you know, what comes in is the legal aspects. You know, at the moment it's illegal to create sperm from stem cells in this country and use them to create embryos that you would then implant. And the other thing is that maybe in 30 years' time, we'll all have realised that you shouldn't leave it too long to start having babies and just have them naturally, because the vast majority of this stuff only applies to people who leave it so long that they can't have babies properly, normally anyway. It's all based around IVF clinics. This isn't normal good fun reproduction.
Moving on from future research to current stuff, James, tell us about the Human Tissue Authority and regulations on how, you know, people can do research nowadays using human tissue.
Yeah, this is the think tank Newton's Apple, who were doing a report actually on cancer research, and almost as a kind of byproduct of that, the one message that they say they were getting regularly from researchers was that, you know, we could get our research out there quicker and we could spend more money on research if we weren't spending lots of administrative time, effort and money on coming up with all the requirements for the regulations, the red tape and etc. to do with the Human Tissue Act. Now that was brought in the aftermath of a couple of nasty scandals where doctors were taking organs from children who had died without the permission of the parents in order to use them in research. But what they're suggesting at Newton's Apple is that there's been a kind of knee-jerk reaction, and frankly, this is kind of I told you so from the scientists, because when the legislation was being brought in 2004, they were saying, you know, this is kind of over the top. And, you know, it seems to be having that effect, because in England and Wales, at least, where the regulations apply to both post-mortem tissue and tissue from living patients, and that incidentally includes urine samples because it's anything with human cells in, there's a huge amount of paperwork you have to fill in. You have to have a license from the Human Tissue Authority that costs you $5,000 plus. And, you know, the scientists are basically saying this is stifling research.
But they're not arguing that they shouldn't have to do all of this stuff. I mean, there must be somewhere in the middle between what they were doing before the Human Tissue Authority Act and what they're doing now, what they have to do now.
Well, what they're arguing for is a review of the regulation and the legislation and hopefully a slimming down of it. And talking to, say, Peter Furness, who is a vice president of the Royal College of Pathologists, his solution is, you know, this sort of stuff shouldn't really apply to tissue from living patients, because by and large, when you ask patients, they say, why on earth are you asking me whether you want to use this tiny part of my biopsy or my urine sample? Don't give them monkeys, you know. Even patients seem to think it's a bit of a waste of time.
When in doubt, do a review. Just before we finish up this section, though, NASA requires urine, boys. Are you going to be sending stuff their way? With 350 millilitres. I know that actually, James, you have much more than 350. You're constantly going out there to sort of relieve yourself.
I don't know where
this is. Litres and litres coming out.
Where is this coming from? There was one thing that caught my eye about this story that I quite like, because there's this personal limit of 350 litres, but NASA seemed to want to, make it clear that this wasn't some kind of target to be exceeded, because they said, on the memo, it says, while this is not a regulation, you are not encouraged to overhydrate, as this could dilate the urine we collect. So
they want quality urine.
Exactly. They don't want people just, you know, filling up on Coke before they go in there in order to kind of come up with some amazingly impressive sample.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Right, let's move on. It's the time of year when I'm sure you're all thinking about holidays to exotic and faraway places. But what if money was no object? Now, I know that all of us in the pod would jump at the chance to get into space for a few days, and that's exactly what video games designer Richard Garriott has decided to do. Best known for creating games such as Akalabeth, Ultima and Bioforge, Garriott will fly to the International Space Station in October. Ian Sample caught up with the soon-to-be spaceman and asked him why he'd decided to make the journey.
My father was a NASA astronaut, and while I think every kid grows up, at least at some moment in their youth, believing or desiring to grow up to be an astronaut, when you live amongst astronauts, I think that desire gets into you a little deeper. But when I was young also, I had one of the NASA physicians come to me when I was a teenager and say, you know, hey, Richard, I'm really sorry, but you're never going to be able to be selected as an astronaut because you have poor eyesight. Yeah. And at the time, that was would rule you out. But versus let that dispel me, I actually think that spurred me on. And I said, well, if I can't be selected as a NASA astronaut, then I'm just going to have to figure out a way that private citizens can get themselves into space. And so I've been an investor in the privatization of space with almost all of my personal investing through my 30-year career in computer gaming. And so Space Adventures, the company that I'm flying with, is actually one of many of these privatization of space investments that I've made down through the years. But fortunately, this is the one that's actually taking me to space.
And your father, he flew on the shuttle and he flew on Skylab in the 80s. Now, did he not have a word with you and put you off?
Oh, not at all. You know, in fact, our whole family grew up with activities around spaceflight being part of our daily life. And so I don't think it was any great surprise to my dad. In fact, he's helped me invest in a lot of these things down through the years, helped me analyze some of these investments. So he's known this has been a big passion of mine since I was quite young, and he's joined me now as my chief scientist and is helping me develop the experiments and things that I'll be taking to space.
What are you going to do when you're up there? I don't know how long you've got exactly, but when
about
you're
10
up
days.
Okay.
And I have quite an extensive list of activities that include everything from commercial work that I'm actually trying to demonstrate that private individuals can go to space not just as a lark or as a vacation, as a tourist, but rather that we can also do not only scientifically relevant work, but frankly, businesses can be built in space that make it financially worthwhile to be in space. And as a non-governmental entity, I'm free to explore that fully. And so I'm doing some work, for example, protein crystal growth, which is both scientifically important and of great assistance to pharmaceutical companies to develop medications to combat a variety of diseases, but is also commercial in the sense of it's something that I'm doing about half of that work for fundamental research and about half of it as a commercial exercise that I'm selling those results to pharmaceutical companies who have paid in advance for their chemicals of their interest to be taken. Mm. I'm also doing a variety of what you might call conservation efforts, where, for example, my dad on Skylab had some of the first opportunities to do a photographic survey of the surface of the Earth. 35 years later, I'm going to go back and retake a lot of those same Earth observation photographs so that we can compare how in one generation of space travel, the Earth has changed. And we're working with a lot of groups like the Nature Conservancy to help define what pictures would be, what shots would be the best and most relevant, and then how to also communicate that to the general public. And then, most interesting, especially for being here in England right now, is I'm working with schools and children around the globe, including here in England with the British National Space Center, to get school kids to provide questions and ideas for experiments, many of which I'm either going to answer from space, sometimes live with some ham radio downlinks, sometimes on video that I'll be recording for some of these experiments that the kids have proposed. And then return that and hopefully inspire another generation of interest in science and technology.
You can hear the full interview with Richard Garriott as this week's Science Extra. Go to guardian.co.uk/science. Back to the bones now. Yelena and Emily are still here. Emily, let's talk about the London's Buried Bones exhibition from your perspective now. So your job is to take some of these skeletons and make them look really sexy. How have you done that? Describe the exhibition to us.
I'm not sure that that was our first priority. we've been working very closely with Yelena and her colleagues at the Museum of London to try and choose 26 individual skeletons from their enormous collection. And there are a few criteria that we were using to make that selection. One of the key things that we wanted to do was to reflect the broad range of fascinating conditions, diseases and traumas that these individuals have suffered from. But also we wanted to reflect the whole geography of London. So what we've tried to do is select individuals from across the different burial grounds. So right from Merton down near Wimbledon to Chelsea to Farringdon, just around the corner from where we are now. So to try and connect people with places that they might go to in London in their kind of everyday life with the history that's gone before
them. So you're
them.
Trying to tell a story of the city as well as the bones themselves.
Exactly. So you can kind of connect with some of these individuals on a geographical level. So you say, oh, this individual has come from underneath where I go to work or where I go to the supermarket. And then you discover this whole individual story through what the bones can tell us. So we might see an individual who's had a terrible fracture to their hip, for example, but we can see from the way that their leg bones haven't wasted away that they've continued to be mobile. So you can kind of imagine how that might have felt. As we take people around the exhibition, you can see kind of different fractures or conditions that they've either suffered from or know people who've suffered from, and they can then imagine not only how their own bones look like, which isn't something that we get the opportunity to do, but also how these past residents of the city lived.
James?
What are the oldest skeletons that you have in the exhibition?
We have three Roman individuals. So, again, the dating is quite broad, but between 200 and 400 approximately.
Do we know very much about those individuals?
We have three different individuals, as I said, and they're from three different burial grounds. The Romans built their cemeteries on the outside of the city. So rather than burying within the city walls of Londinium, they were on the roads outside, going outside of London, so to the east, to the west, and to the north. One of the individuals is from the Western Burial Ground, which is just underneath Holborn Viaduct. He's got a series of very small holes across his skeleton, but most particularly his skull area, which suggests that he was suffering from a condition called multiple myeloma, which is a kind of blood cancer. So the bones of the Romans give us as much information about their health, really, as any of the post-medieval ones.
And there was a lovely example of a young woman who was discovered at the Royal Mint.
That's a good story. She's a beautiful example of a complete skeleton, so that's an opportunity in the exhibition to see that. But also she reflects very clearly how the remains that are buried underneath London are affected by what's happening above ground. So while from the neck down she's perfectly normal and bone-coloured, her head and neck have been stained green by the copper residues from the coin manufacture that was happening at the Royal Mint in the site above her. The soil conditions can have a large effect on how the bones appear when they're uncovered, and this is a particularly visible one.
Tell us about William Wood as well, this Chelsea butcher and beadle. What is a beadle, first of all?
Beadle's a kind of minor church official, so it sort of reflects his status in the community. He'd have been quite well respected. But he's one of the named individuals that were excavated from Chelsea Old Church. So their coffin plates were discovered alongside them, so we were able to identify them. He seems to have been a bit of a character, one of Jelena's favourites.
Yes.
He was also the butcher, as well as being the beadle. And that's something that, although we know from the records, we can also pick up on from the skeleton. So he suffered from a condition called Dish, and Jelena's brought along an example of that.
Which one is that?
Of Dish.
It's that one there with the vertebrae.
Okay, so this is...
He wasn't just particularly attractive.
No, he had no teeth, so no.
Six vertebrae fused together.
Yes.
All rather brown with a rib, or part of a rib sticking out.
It looks
out.
Like a bit of wood, really, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It looks like some kind of gnarled bit of wood you might find on the beach or something like that. But yeah, sorry, tell us.
Well, the bit that we're looking at is... where the vertebrae fuse together, there is a sort of extra bony growth, which is appears like dripping wax.
It's like wax.
Oh, right, gosh, yeah.
And that is a condition that is associated with a high-protein diet and is quite often seen in men of a certain age who are overweight, obese, or who might have type 2 diabetes.
And would this guy have perhaps had gout as well at the same time or something like that?
I don't think he actually showed up as having gout, but we do sometimes see gout, yes. But
certainly he lived well anyway.
Yes, he lived well, yeah. He also had osteoarthritis of both his hips.
So that suggests some load-bearing.
Load-bearing on that.
And does this mean that he wouldn't have been able to articulate these vertebrae because they're kind of fused together by this growth?
He would have probably had sort of slightly less mobility, quite stiff, but it wouldn't have affected him that much because that's actually the front part as opposed to those back that articulate more. So he probably would have been a bit stiff. His hips probably would have given him more problem with the osteoarthritis.
I don't know. Better yoga, he'd have been sorted. We've been talking about bones for half an hour now, and skeletons and that kind of thing, and they are absolutely fascinating, and they look great. And Emily, final word to you. Is the sort of staring at bones in exhibitions, is it a bit macabre, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, it's always tricky when you're dealing with human remains, and we're always very mindful of that and very respectful. We treat each individual as an individual. But I think the skeletons are so immediately fascinating. And then as you learn more about them, they become more so. I think there isn't perhaps an initial reticence, but that soon it kind of disappears as you find out more and more about these individuals. And through the kind of work that Jelena and her colleagues do, we're actually kind of building up a bigger picture about these. We're kind of de-anonymizing them. So it's almost feels like... I was going to say a terrible pun then, and I'm not going to do it.
No, do. Puns, we love puns.
we're not punning on human remains. But we are treating them as individuals, and I think we're giving them their chance to shine. And I think that... the overall feeling of the exhibition won't be one of sort of morbid and macabre, but one that's kind of fascinating insight into their lives and the history of the city.
I think it'd be quite fascinating for people to just see skeletons. You don't get to see skeletons very often.
No. And they're immediately identifiable. I mean, that's, you know, that's what's inside everybody, and everyone's always fascinated by that. Children particularly just absolutely adore it. And then if someone has injured themselves in any way, then they sort of go along and think, oh, I've got that, I've done that, yes.
Yeah, so, and particularly with the teeth.
I mean, the teeth,
really,
yes.
You can really empathise with some of that pain.
Yeah, abscess.
We'll leave all of that there, but if listeners want to empathise with lots of pain and that kind of thing, and enjoy watching Looking at Skeletons...
You can listen to next week's show.
You can listen... Yeah. The pain part...
Is that painful?
The pain part you can listen to next week's show, but really, the fascinating stuff is going to be the Welcome Collection from Wednesday, 23rd of July, so go along to that. And Yelena and Emily, thank you very much for coming in to tell us all about it. Well, that's it for this week's show, or Bonecast, if you will. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science to find links to all the stories we've discussed and to comment on them. Post a comment there or on our Facebook wall. My thanks to Ian Sample and James Randerson. Science Weekly was produced by Pete Sale. I'm Alok Jha. Have a great week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.